This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad. Continue with me, Tan Chung Han and Brian Finnes with the top business stories of the day. Now, let's turn our attentions to the tourism tax that was causing quite a bit of controversy some months ago when it was proposed. According to the tourism minister, Dato' Sri Nazri Aziz, states will get 5 ringgit for every 10 ringgit collected. That's higher than the 1 ringgit initially earmarked for state governments. Here's the minister with more details on the allocation.
Pembahagian cukai ini akan dibuat secara saksama berdasarkan peratusan kutipan cukai pelancongan di negeri masing-masing. Setiap negeri boleh menggunakan peruntukan ini bagi membangunkan sektor pelancongan masing-masing, khususnya promosi dan pemasaran destinasi yang lebih agresif, penganjuran acara-acara pelancongan, pembangunan modal insan dan penyelenggaraan projek-projek pelancongan berskala kecil.
That was Tourism Minister Dato' Sri Nazri Aziz. Question now is, where does that leave the hotel industry? On the line, we have Shahrudin Syed, Executive Director of the Malaysian Association of Hotel Owners, also known as MAHO. Han, you speak to him.
Good morning, Shahrudin. So given this development with the tourism tax, right, state governments getting half of the proceeds, where does that leave you guys? Are you getting your fair share?
Good morning, Han. Thank you for calling me. Well, it's good to talk again on this issue after we talked the last time in August. Well, we are happy that the government is allocating about 5 ringgit to the states from the tourism tax, but we have yet to see how much will go to the stakeholders, especially to the hotel sector, which we are being given the task to collect and pay the tax to the government. And, you know, when we started implementation, it costs us some budget to upgrade the system and so on. We have not got any terms or anything on reimbursement for that. We have not seen any proposal that we can have a share of the tourism tax on any way that we would like to spend on the promotion or whatever it is. So I think it's still... No idea. We have to maybe meet up or talk to the Ministry of Tourism or Tourism Malaysia on how much of this tourism tax collection, which is about 39.9 million for 4 months, and that's average about 10 million a month. And we thought it could be more because still up to now, the hotels are collecting only the registered hotels with the Ministry of Tourism, and the one that still operating, as I mentioned before, the Airbnb service apartments are still not being looked in to collect the tax, even though the ministry has told us they'll be doing something for that. But until now, there's nothing.
Right. So now, if you guys do eventually, hopefully, get a share of those proceeds, how do you plan to use it? Is it to offset those implementation costs for the tourism tax? Is that the idea?
Definitely. Firstly, we have to cover back on the cost that we've been incurred for the implementation. Then anything excess, we of course will plow it back into the promotion of the sales or marketing. Probably we do it together with the ministry and so on. So we'll do it on a very effective strategy, but we need to work with the ministry. And also on the question of the 5 ringgit goes to the states, we hope that they will make use the money of effectively for tourism promotion. And we are not pleased if this money is used by the Ministry of Tourism just to pay back the outstanding bills for the past years, you see.
Thank you for your time. That was Shahrudin Syed, Executive Director of the Malaysian Association of Hotel Owners, better known as MAHO. I think we also have to do a little shout out to his children in the background there.
No, those are the hotel owners crying. They didn't even share the proceeds. Just a quick factoid though. So the government has collected almost 40 million ringgit since the tourism tax was implemented September 1st until December 31st last year.
Okay, let's move on to the question of Malaysia's debt levels. Are they still manageable? Well, according to the Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Najib, they are. Malaysia's debt-to-GDP ratio is currently below 51%, which the Prime Minister says is within Malaysia's means.
Soalnya bukan sangat saiz hutang, tapi kemampuan kita bayar balik. Kalau sebut Singapura punya hutang lebih besar lagi. Tapi kemampuan membayar balik memang tetap ada. Jadi kita ada kemampuan bayar balik yang tak boleh dipersoalkan kerana badan-badan penarafan antarabangsa telah meletakkan Malaysia dalam kategori A.
That was the Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Najib Razak.
Yeah, so let's look at the actual number itself. So it stands at 50.8% of GDP, now below the self-imposed ceiling by the government of 55%. Now, here's a regional sort of a global comparison between the debt-to-GDP ratios of different countries. And this is only for government debt. Now, Singapore, so it stands at 112%. The UK is at 89%, Canada 92%, and Japan, it's over 200%. Those are developed countries though. But guys, if you look, according to Bloomberg data, if you look at the region, say Malaysia is among those countries which in fact has a higher GDP to debt ratio, sorry, debt to GDP ratio among emerging economies. So if you look at Vietnam, for example, it's over 60%, but our regional neighbours, Thailand, Indonesia, Philippines, Taiwan, South Korea, all have lower debt-to-GDP ratios than we do.
Yeah, and if I may quote Yanis Varoufakis here, the former Greek finance minister, he wrote this lovely book, Adult in the Room. If you can do a bit of reading here, page 30-something or so.
is that as far as you got?
Yeah, pretty much. I went through two chapters and my brain is ready to explode. All right, so why are we talking about debt to GDP, though? And he writes it really well here. So he says this, and I quote, "It helps to think of public debt as a hole in the ground next to a mountain representing the nation's national income. As long as the mountain rises faster than the debt hole deepens, the extra income added to the mountain summit can be shoveled into the adjacent hole." So that's why we kind of talk about debt to GDP ratios there. Yanis Varoufakis, shout out.
Okay, he was just in town recently, and Melissa spoke to him on The Breakfast Grill. You can always download that podcast. But what about the question of contingent liabilities and other off-budget items? We often hear about how they can be a risk to public finances.
Yeah, so in Moody's report from December, right, there was this question asked, you know, and I quote, "Do government guarantees present material contingent liability risks?" The short answer, probably not. Again, that's from Moody's, yeah? Because they say this about Malaysia's government guarantees, okay? And again, I quote, "Government guarantees are issued through a relatively stringent selection process and most companies that benefit from them are profitable and competently managed." Also, if you look at, say, Moody's report on China from about 2016, this is something that I pulled up, and they talk about how the experience from other countries, so beyond China, outside of China, right, shows that only a fraction of state-owned entity-related contingent liabilities typically crystallize. So again, in Moody's eyes, when it comes to Malaysia's risks, probably not. Again, this is the relationship between government guarantees and contingent liability risks.
You know, Han, what was interesting when we were doing research on this was actually the fact that relative to other countries, our numbers are actually quite smaller. So I think when you have a basis of comparison with other countries, it doesn't seem as big a problem as many of us think it is.
Yeah, that may be, but I think there are also questions of trust in this conversation about debt. And of course, the 1MDB story has eroded much of public confidence that those steering government finances know what they're doing, especially because there's been a lack of accountability in the troubles around 1MDB.
Sure. Now, these two narratives, they are not mutually exclusive. You can have those concerns and certainly express them, be it on 1MDB or other state-owned entities, right, when it comes to managing their finances. But at the same time, what we are focusing on here is the overall debt affordability of the Malaysian government. So there are two different narratives here.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let's take a look at the question, not just the quantum of debt, but the interest payments as a share of government revenue. That was the basis of a question put to government and parliament yesterday.
Yeah, so it comes back to your question about affordability, Han. So now these numbers are from an article in the Straits Times, which is mentioned in parliament yesterday. Now, Putrajaya spends 12.5% of its revenue to service its debt payments, and that's up from 9% in 2009 when Dato' Sri Najib became prime minister. Now, this year, Putrajaya expects to pay 31 billion in interest. Now, that's more than double it from 2009. Singapore, in contrast, only pays just over 6%, 6.1%. So that's more than twice of Singapore. Again, to be clear, but it's about the ratio and the ability to service that debt.
Yeah, so yesterday I reached out to an economist to get a better perspective on this, right? You know, like with this rising interest payments as a ratio to total revenue. So the question to be posed here is this, okay? Who gets those interest payments? And the short answer to that, it's generally Malaysians or local state-linked funds. Again, I go back to Moody's, okay? They say this, and I quote, "Importantly, two-thirds of overall government debt is held by domestic investors that are large and long-term investors such as the EPF, banks, and Co-op." So it's one thing, all right, for these interest payments to be going offshore to foreign investors who may not have the mandate to invest here in the local economy, but it's something else if it's local entities who get those interest payments and translates into EPF dividends, you know, funds for shareholders, investments, loans, etc.
Okay, well, let's move on from the debt story to the question of UMW Holdings. It's announced a plan to acquire a majority stake in MBM Resources. They intend to follow that up with a mandatory takeover offer for the rest of its shares. This essentially would allow it to take a controlling 70% stake in Perdua. But the question is this a good deal for MBM Resources shareholders?
All right, so before we get to that, just some context here, backstory. So last Friday, UMW Holdings offered to acquire just over half of MBM Resources, and that's going to cost them about 500 million ringgit cash. And then after that, they also plan to make a mandatory general offer for the shares that they do not own. All right, so to answer your question, Sharad, according to some analysts, the answer is no.
Yeah, because they reckon that UMW's bid to control Perodua and MBM Resources may not go through because of pricing. Now, some analysts argue that UMW's 2.56 ringgit per share offer for the just over 50% stake in MBM Resources was an unattractive offer because it was a steep discount to MBM's net asset per share. Now, according to Afin Huang Capital, they say that the price is too low because it's at a 30% discount to its net asset value. Hong Leong Investment, however, sees it as 20% less than the estimated sum of parts valuation. So in short, really unattractive price that's being offered.
Yeah, well, certainly see how UMW and MBM Resources share prices fare in just a couple of minutes from now when the markets open. So obviously, you know, from MBM Resources, they're saying, well, not good enough. From UMW's perspective, well, that's a good deal. It's cheap.
Okay. Well, coming up to the top of the news, we'll have the bulletin, and then, of course, we'll be back with opening numbers in the stock market, more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.